Our company goal is to flatten the methane curve, and we can actually achieve it. And what I mean by that is methane is, again, a uniquely solvable problem in that the amount of methane that goes in the atmosphere and the amount of methane that comes out of the atmosphere, the imbalance is only 3%.
I think it's a healthy tension. You need to stay at some level adhered to the underlying principle of the technology, but then you've got to be flexible to kind of meet the market.
I distinctly remember the first big leak that we caught. He said, "But I don't believe the emissions rate." And we said, "Well, to tell us more." And he said, "Well, if this emissions rate is true, that was a third of the production from that pad."
This is the ProCo 360 podcast for people who love Colorado and love hearing from Colorado's most inventive and successful entrepreneurs. I'm Dave Tabor, and in this episode, I'll be joined in studio by Ian Dickinson and Greg Reeker, co-founders of Longpath Technologies. Ian is CEO, Greg is CTO, and this conversation will talk about how Longpath's technology that monitors air emissions around oil and gas wells helps energy production companies better manage emissions and regulators better measure with precision the emissions in the monitored areas. First, I'm excited to dig into the journey of how the technology Longpath uses went from being born at CU Boulder and NIST and being awarded a Nobel Prize to being commercialized and earlier this month having the Department of Energy guarantee a loan for $189 million to help the company expand. That's a lot. Ian, Greg, glad you're with me on ProCo 360.
Great to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
We'll get to the $189 million. That is a lot. But first, I gave a quick intro about Longpath. Why don't you guys give a better one?
Yeah, so Longpath is, I think, is a great intro. So we provide methane and other greenhouse gas detection for oil and gas, but the application or the technology's got broader application. So it has application in agriculture, landfills, mining, but that's the focus right now. And, you know, we partner with the oil and gas operators in the upstream, midstream, and downstream.
Yeah. So, you know, oil and gas production infrastructure is vast. And so when the gas is coming up out of the ground, there's a lot of infrastructure that needs to be there in order to capture it and move it to where it needs to be in the market. So there's a lot of potential places for leakage to happen. So the problem that we're solving is making it possible for operators to continuously monitor this vast infrastructure and let them know very quickly where leakage is happening.
Good. And we're going to come back to that because there's something. I watched a video from your chief scientist that really shed some light on it. But before we do that, I want to, like, can either of you, for a layperson, and I had Rob from Atom Computing try to explain quantum computing to me, and I gave up, of course. But a frequency comb, yeah. That's the Nobel Prize-winning technology that you're using, right?
Yeah.
So what is it?
Yeah, so a frequency comb, it's kind of, so maybe just to back up a bit and say what Longpath looks like in the field.
Yeah.
So we place centralized towers. At the top of the tower, there's a laser head that sends out this invisible laser beam. It can go travel up to miles away, and it can sweep out the area, a bit like a radar, you know, for methane.
Yeah.
So how this works is actually very similar to, you know, what causes the climate change from things like methane. And that is that methane molecules will absorb light at very specific colors, especially in the infrared. And so we take a laser, in this case, a frequency comb, and this is a laser that emits hundreds of thousands of colors of light. And we send it out. And when the light comes back, there's certain wavelengths, certain colors of light that are missing. And if those correspond to the wavelengths that match with where methane absorbs, we know that there was methane there.
Ah, and that comb, the frequency comb, essentially is because different wavelengths have different peaks, it's like a comb, right? And so if you can match the peak to what you're looking for, you know what you've got, essentially?
Exactly. Yep. Mm-hmm. So methane, CO2, water, everything absorbs at these very different set of colors. And so we comb basically all of the colors, and then we look specifically for methane.
So you can do that with massive remote sort of access by shooting out a beam. You can figure out what's in the air miles away.
That's right.
Yeah. Wow. Now, go ahead.
Yeah, I would say, you know, from a layman's term, we can see what would be a quarter of a human breath of methane from miles away. So there's methane in the air all the time, right? The room we're sitting in has methane in it. And so what we're looking for is a differential. which would be, you know, specific to the facility we're monitoring. So we're looking for that change in methane, but the system's incredibly sensitive, which allows us to be very accurate in detecting and then quantifying the size of that emission.
I can see the value escalating here to a producer, an energy producer. And I watched a video, I kind of geeked out about it a little bit, from your co-founder and chief scientist, Carolyn Alden. And I thought it was fascinating because your product changes the way emissions are noted, like recorded, whether there's an emissions problem or not, and how it's added up. Because what I gather from this video is that leaks aren't like on and off. They're intermittent. And not only are they intermittent, but they're variable. And so being able to capture exactly sort of the actual the quantities in this way is different from whether, like, hey, you leaked or you didn't leak. And the importance, I'm going on and on about this, but I found it fascinating that basically it's important to the people who monitor air and also to the companies whose operations are in question. Like, really, what is this? What's really? So anyway, talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the biggest challenges to really understand that total emissions footprint, right? In an environment, as Greg described, where you've got complex infrastructure and you've got this this intermittent leak dynamic, right? And so, you know, we have to take many readings over a long period of time to really understand that kind of emission flow rate. And what we're really trying to understand is this something that's persistent and something that is addressable? What's the size of the emission, and then allowing the operators then to kind of optimize the way in which they're going to respond. But that notion of intermittency is a complexity that really requires that the system not only give you kind of good spatial coverage, if that makes sense, but also good temporal or time coverage, right? So you're seeing readings on a very frequent basis so that you can characterize and address, you know, the emissions profile that you're seeing.
And to be clear, producers, energy producers, people drilling or people conveying gas through pipelines or whatever the case, midstream, downstream, they all want to prevent leaks,
yes,
don't they? I mean, it's their product, but it's also massive fines and all that, right? So in this way, how does your system help them prevent or solve this problem more than what's already been out there?
More efficiently, yeah. So most of the other technologies that are out there are snapshot, and we call them snapshot in time technologies. It might be an airplane that flies over and is looking down, you know, with a laser looking for methane as well. And so that's nice, but given that the emissions are intermittent and that they're variable in size, a snapshot in time doesn't give you much. And so
we have to get lucky.
Exactly.
Or unlucky, depending on which perspective.
Exactly. Yeah. And we've actually, as a continuous ground monitor, we've seen both ways. So we've seen situations where a flyover will occur of a facility we're monitoring, and they won't see something that, you know, 3 days later we pick something up that the airplane missed. We'll see it the other way around, where there's a very short intermittent emission, you know, something just a you know, seal cracking for a moment, letting out some gas, and that'll get caught by the airplane. Hmm. But, you know, 3 hours later, there's nothing.
Yeah.
And it's been quiet for the week before. So
it seems to me that, first of all, your value proposition seems to be massive and so clear. Like, anybody who is regulated around these kinds of things would definitely want the kind of intermittent sort of monitoring, because both A, you'll solve a problem more quickly, and B, like, their fines, they could fine based on quantity of emission, right? So if you can show that, in fact, it was intermittent and less than, like, this massive on, then their fines are down as well.
Yeah. And in the oil field, I mean, there's a logistics challenge, right? You're talking about vast areas. And so the teams need to organize themselves to respond accordingly. And so the oil and gas operators are confronted with a series of challenges. One, they want to keep the gas in the pipe. They want to operate efficiently. But they also need to make sure their workforce is deployed in an efficient manner. And so being able to understand, characterize the emissions that are happening across their infrastructure allows them to meet kind of various goals for different stakeholders, not only within the company, but more broadly.
Yeah.
You know, so it's...
So sending somebody out to two different locations, one that's barely emitting and just doing it intermittently, the other one is a massive leak, they need to know the difference.
Well, I'll give you an example, right? So you could see a very large leak that's intermittent, right? And let's say it's timed perfectly with a spot check or a flyover. You then dispatch somebody who needs to drive 2 hours out to that facility, right? And the leak's not there. And so they've just spent 4 hours on the road, right? And they arrive at the facility and there's no leak to repair. And so being able to really understand that persistent versus intermittent leak dynamic from an operator standpoint is important. But it also speaks clearly to the overall emissions profile of those assets.
And that also, I mean, to the extent that I've heard that leaks account for much of the air emissions about which we're concerned. And to the extent, and they're generally pretty inexpensive to fix. Is that,
yes,
right?
I mean, there's a really compelling return on investment. Again, because this is the product, right, that's escaping.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what we found in most of the folks we're working with, and most of the systems we're monitoring or facilities we're monitoring is that, you know, a monitoring program using LongPath more than pays for itself. It creates a pretty high return on that investment.
Yeah, I would think, like, is there anyone that tells you no?
Yes.
Why? Like, seriously, like, why? They have deep, generally, energy companies have deep pockets. They want to solve this. They're highly motivated. Why would someone say no?
Well, in defense of, you know, these are our partners. I mean, there's, the regulatory environment is still in flux. There's been a lot of clarity provided in the recent months, but for a lot of these operators, it's not clear yet what it is that they're required to do from a regulatory standpoint. In addition, it's a fairly sizable operational transformation, right? Mm. So if you go from, if you can imagine going from spot checking a facility twice a year to having the lights turned on, now you're watching every facility 24/7. And now you've got these leaks that you really are obligated to respond to. And so we work very closely with the operators to think through how do you not only get some clarity in terms of what's going to be required of you, but how do you think about the work practices and the operational transformation to be able to respond effectively?
Yeah, but you do have big investors from the industry. So
yes.
Clearly,
yes.
You know, Williams and who's the other?
ConocoPhillips.
ConocoPhillips. Yeah. Clearly those, you know, they get it.
They do.
Get it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so all the operators, I think, understand and are motivated. And we can talk about, you know, look, Colorado's, the operators here in Colorado are really fantastic. I mean, Colorado, when you compare it to the other basins that we monitor, the oil and gas basins, Colorado's top tier performer in terms of its emissions profile. And that's due to the fact that they've paid a lot of attention to quality system design, to good response protocols. The regulatory environment in Colorado has kind of forced some of this, but it's also been kind of a mindset. But yes, I mean, we've got great insight from investors who are operators.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is a real collaborative effort between us and the client.
Well, that's got to help when you've got industry leaders who are investing and on board. Clearly, they want to adopt, and they
yes.
are. So, they all are. Right, I want to shift gears. Because I was interested in your value proposition. I'm interested because ultimately what you're doing is helping to solve a lot of the macro emissions issues. And to the extent it's adopted everywhere, the air gets cleaner. So so glad for that. Now I want to shift to how this business emerged from the lab because that's such an amazing story. And we hear technology or examples of technology that's born out of labs. I've always had trouble sort of getting my head around it. So tell the story of like – I mean this wasn't – this technology wasn't designed to solve the problem you're solving now. It was designed as what? Why did someone even start – exploring this.
Making it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So what's interesting about the frequency comb, again, it's this laser that emits 100,000 up to 1,000,000 colors of light. And they call it a comb because the frequencies are perfectly spaced. And they're perfectly spaced by the pulsing rate of the laser. And so that's a lot to bring down. But what this means is that you can measure the pulsing rate of the laser and you can know where every single color is. So it was actually originally developed as a bit of a frequency ruler to be able to measure, you know, one color versus another and know exactly basically exactly what every color and every frequency
was. It was supposed to be a tool for researchers, essentially?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Not a product.
That's right. And so, you know, I'd lived in the lab for many years, and I joined... I'm an engineer by training, and I joined with a bunch of physicists at NIST in about 2012. And the comb technology had been around for about 13 years at that point, still kind of in the laboratory. And it was, I tell people, it's a bit like walking into a garage and there's, you know, Lamborghini over in the corner, you know, and you say, wow, could I drive that? And they say, oh, that old thing? Sure. You know, because the physicists had been using it for years and doing some really nice work with it, you know, along around frequency metrology and things, but maybe hadn't thought of trying to use it in the way that we were thinking of using it for
did
a sensor.
Did they think it was going to win a Nobel Prize? I mean, did they, when they discovered this and figured out how to harness this technology, did they realize that it was that big?
I think, So, you know, at University of Colorado, I work with a lot of the original researchers that were there in the lab at the time. And I do think they knew that they had something very special. Mm-hmm. And because it there's so many different things that you could do with it. And they did know at the time that you could use it as a sensor like this.
They did. Did the inventors, it's a team, right? Mm-hmm. Do they... Yeah. Apply to win the Nobel Prize, or does somebody like see it?
Yeah, so it's an interesting thing that the Nobel Prize is it's given to specific people, and it's really for a body of work. So it's funny to say Nobel Prize winning invention because it's not really for the frequency comb. It's to Jan Hall from University of Colorado and NIST, this joint institute called JILA, and you know, he just had a long body of really good work that sort of culminated in the frequency comb, and that's how they give it. So yeah, you don't ask for it. They call you up at 3 in the morning and say you won.
Were you part of that team?
I was not here at that time. I showed up in 2012 as kind of one of the early engineers, I would say, that kind of walked into the physics building, you know, into the room with the physicists and said, "Wow, this is cool."
But the entrepreneur had entered the room in 2012, and that is the beginning of the origin story, right? And before my time, I joined the company in 2020, late 2020, but Greg and ultimately the other founders that came together in 2015 had the vision for a commercial application that could have a huge impact in the world. So taking this incredible technology and then launching onto this adventure that they've been on for 12 years.
Oh, and did you see it specifically in the application for which you're using it now? Is that how you, I guess, put that concept together?
Yeah, so it was an interesting convergence as well. So I came to the lab as an engineer interested in how this technology could be used in practical application. Oil and gas was not really on the chart at that moment. And it came down to an interesting thing at NIST where I came from a combustion background, so I was going to use this tool as a way to look into combustion systems and understand what's happening. But it turns out at NIST, you can't burn anything. They're very scared of that. But they're perfectly okay if you shoot the laser beam out the window over 2 kilometers up towards a hiking path, you know, and it is eye safe, so it's okay. But but they're perfectly okay with that. And that was a way for us to test out the system in a practical application. And so we just did it as a demonstration, but we quickly noticed how sensitive it was for measuring all of these gases. And so right around that time, Brian Wilson, who's a professor at Colorado State University, was at ARPA-E. It's the Department of Energy's Advanced Research Projects Agency. He had recognized this problem of the need for monitoring around oil and gas. So he put out a call for proposals. We had just demonstrated the technology and we brought them together.
Cool. I'm going to take a quick break here. You're listening to ProCo 360, named Best Colorado Business Podcast of the last 3 years. I'm your host, Dave Tabor, and this is the podcast for people who love Colorado and the stories of Colorado business and entrepreneurs. My guests are Ian Dickinson and Greg Rieker, co-founders of Longpath Technologies. Hey, I want to thank our sponsors, Kinsley Meetings, and Kinsley Meetings has been ProCo 360's longest running sponsor. sponsor. The business is growing based on a great reputation for planning and conducting meetings with lots of complexity and all over the world. Also, my friends at Via Technologies, thanks for hosting ProCo 360 and all the great help your team gives me around managing the very data-heavy website. And Colorado Biz Magazine, our partnership is one of building our audiences together. Finally, we've got something going now with Denver Angels. We're partnering to support stories of Colorado entrepreneurs. Go to proco360.com and check out all these great partners. I want to get back to, by the way, Greg, my son was a mechanical engineering student and had you as a professor at CU.
Yeah.
I said, do you remember this guy? He goes, yes, I had him. So anyway, had to make sure I gave a shout out to Matt. So anyway, at 2023, you got Series A funding, which included your customers you mentioned before, ConocoPhillips and Williams. As you've brought them on, did they help you craft the direction of the product and the development of the product, or did they just say, put it in the field, we're ready?
Well, I'd say the former. Would you agree?
Yeah.
I think it's a bit of a combination. I mean, this technology has been quite matured over a 10-year period leading into this Series A and this investment from Conoco and Williams. But there is still this sorting out of how best to apply the technology in the field. And so, for example, with Conoco, we're working through a very detailed joint development agreement on how do we use this technology in an optimized way across a very broad set of operating basins. So, it's an ongoing development process, and they've brought a lot of perspective to us in terms of, you know, an operator's perspective.
I would think, I mean, when you have somebody bringing money and expertise and signing on to use your product as it evolves, I mean, that's sort of the home run, isn't it?
Well, and it was very intentional. You know, when we went out to raise the Series A, we were very conscious about the value that would be derived from bringing in industry partners.
I would say that, you know, every entrepreneur wants to get into the head of their customer. And so having your customer invested in the company and sort of in your head, in your face all the time, that's kind of the best possible outcome.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, I want to talk about transitioning from the lab to the business more. And LongPath is for real now. I get it. But at what point did it feel like it had come from the lab and it become a business?
Yeah. So, every entrepreneur says you have to sort of fake it till you make it. And around 2020 was when the technology had matured enough that we were ready, I think, to go out and try to do something commercial. And so we did our first, the installations before that, I would call them pre-commercial. Commercial installation in 2020 is the first one where a customer is paying.
When someone pays you and they expect you to deliver.
Exactly. Yeah. And so we got our LongPath branded hard hats and got some magnets and stuck them on the side of the trucks we rented to take down to the oil field there and do the installation. And it was in those first couple of systems that we put out there that we ran them as a commercial system. I distinctly remember the first big leak that we caught for this operator. And we were on in a meeting with the operator, and they said, this is great. You found the leak. You found it within a few hours. We went out. It was just a stuck valve. We kicked it shut. Everything was ready to go again. And he said, but I don't believe the emissions rate. And we said, well, tell us more. And he said, well, if this emissions rate is true, that was a third of the production from that pad. And that couldn't be. It was this stuck valve. And he said, I would see it in my output numbers. And so he said, here, let me pull it up. So he pulls up his SCADA system that shows his output number. And he said, wait a minute, what was the date? You know, and he sits back in his chair and he shows us, and you could see a drop in the production and then it coming back up. And he sat back in the chair and he said, wow, okay. This is, you know, that's something that happens often in the field. And so I think that was a bit of an eye-opening moment for them. It was a great moment for us to understand that the value is not just kicking shut that valve, that is a much more meaningful thing than maybe the operators were thinking before.
Yeah. And how to get it to the field, it's one thing, like you can try it in one location, but when you get it on the field, now you've got communication systems, you've got weather, you got all kinds of, like, was most of the challenge of actually deploying in the field related to the product itself, or was it some other stuff?
Well, do you want to talk about the early commercial pilots? I mean,
yeah, I would
mean,
say
a lot of the work that you guys did, and just to be clear on the timeline, so 2015 is when the process started to really in earnest move the technology out of the lab into a process of miniaturizing, field hardening, and then getting all these lessons learned out in the wild, right? So birds pooping on the mm-hmm. on the retroreflectors, you know, all kinds of stuff that was discovered in this process over, you know, the better part of a 5-year period. I think we're still learning, but I mean, the system now is quite mature. But yeah, I mean, I think by the time I got involved, which was in late 2020, the
hard work was done.
A lot of the hard work was done, but there's been transformation at an underlying technology level since then. And so there's been transformation with the technology, but now the business has started to transform. So as you start to contact the market and you start getting that voice of the customer and you start understanding what they're facing and how the system needs to be adjusted and modulated to meet that coming into contact with the market changes everything. Right?
Well, that was a question I wanted to ask you, and we probably can't even include Greg in this question. But that is, like, how hard of a mind shift is it for a business to go from being engineers driven to, like, make something cool mm-hmm. versus a business that's expected to make profits, sell, have sales messaging, you know, all that?
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, and, one of the things that I would say was unique about Greg and the other founders, and you include me in the founder group as a later ad, but was a really conscious approach to that important inflection point, which is going from the hard science and the hard proof points to saying, how do we make a commercial fit here? And I think it's a healthy tension. In a technology company like LongPath, and this would be true for any technology company, you need to stay at some level adhered to the underlying principle of the technology. But then you've got to be flexible to kind of meet the market, right? So there's a little bit of the art of the sale. There's maybe taking risks that you might not take in a straight kind of laboratory environment. And so I think it's been a really interesting journey for us, Greg and I, and for the broader team to make that transition from just the lab to that contact with the market, those partnerships, figuring out pricing. How do you price this?
Huh.
You don't know how to price it. There isn't. It's not like it was an industry that had been there for 10 years that we were just coming in and disrupting. It's brand new. And so you've got to think about, well, how are they reacting to that price? And then you got to do your bottoms up, like, well, what kind of return do we want to generate? And then, how do we take more costs out of the system?
Well, there's also the idea that, you know, Greg's story earlier was like, you saved this guy a third of his production. And if he hadn't discovered it, it would have been a third of production for a long, long time.
Yes.
So do you charge based on value? Because that's a lot of money sometimes. But then they don't adopt it, right? But it's a tricky, tricky thing.
Yeah. And it's so there's a lot of dynamics to it, but I think, you know, that in this case, and there's every entrepreneurial story, every tech launch is different, but in this story, there's this amazing chapter of taking something that was a piece of lab physics equipment into a commercial application, and then from a commercial application into a business that is still grappling with how to tackle the problem.
You still are?
The industry is still grappling with how to tackle
the industry,
the problem.
But I was thinking you're still talking about, like, how to approach the industry, how to sell to the industry.
Well, and I think that's always the case, even in mature businesses.
Yeah,
you could have
a
mature, you know, you're always trying to figure out that product market fit, but it's amplified here because this is new and this problem is new and there are a lot of competing forces. And so, I think this transformation to where we are today is really a credit to the combination of the founders are still with the business, still committed to the business, passionate about the impact we're driving. And then we brought in some really smart commercial people to say, hey, how do we guide ourselves into, you know, market expansion and long-term growth?
Well, speaking of that, $189 million from the Department of Energy as a loan, essentially a guaranteed loan. Yep. They must have a massive interest in your success. Aside from the money piece, they just want you to win, right? So, I mean, how did that? Am I reading that the tea leaves right on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, Greg, the genesis of our effort with the Department of Energy on this loan started with you serving on a panel with Jigar Shah, who runs the loan program office. He said, Greg, your company's a child of the Department of Energy through the old RPE grants. You must put an application. And Greg came back from that DC trip and said, we should look into this.
That's a lot of money, though.
It's 2 years ago we started that process.
But $189 million.
It was well worth it. Yeah, it's a good return.
But I mean, what are you going to – and this is a loan, right?
It is.
And you take it as you need it.
Yeah.
Or did you get it all out? They write you a check for $189 million.
Yeah, it's a loan facility we can draw on.
Right.
Right, to build out the network of systems, towers and systems, right? Well, so we can draw on it to build that network.
I thought
out.
Your customers would pay for those. Is that not?
Well, they're still going to pay for it because we have to pay the loan back. Right. So
are your customers like a subscription model and you got to build the infrastructure?
Yeah, great question. So we put the infrastructure out. We put the network of sensors out. We maintain it almost like a telecom network. So
yeah, I'm thinking like cell phone stuff.
Yeah, like cell phone towers, right? And we're providing basically a monitoring bandwidth to everything within the purview of that network.
So you can have multiple customers all from one tower.
All from one tower.
Oh.
Right. And then what we charge is basically a monthly recurring subscription fee or a data as a service charge.
Is it based on the volume that they're extracting?
Nope.
Is it what? No?
No, it's just based on it's based on a
maybe it should be.
Well, it could. And, you know, like a gain share model would be interesting, right? We've got one operator who said, look, I invested $400,000 in monitoring the long path and saved $3.5 million in what would have been lost product.
That's a great success story, except you didn't get your cut.
Well, we got what we charged.
I know, but it's really fascinating to think that with one tower, you know, and if you really did a parallel with cell phone service, right, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Of course, as they shut down those leaks, then so does your revenue go away.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we've found a really nice balance in terms of what we charge and it creating a really attractive return.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's real ROI in this. That story I just told you, there's actually a piece in Bloomberg put together on that story. And so, you know, we're providing really great value to the operators.
But getting back to the loan, basically, you've got to build towers, you got to set up equipment, you have to put the entire infrastructure in place.
That's right.
In order to serve your first customer.
That's right.
And the first customer won't pay for that.
Well, so what the customer will do is,
they'll pay, but they won't pay that.
Right. And so like any kind of capital intensive tech enabled data as a service, again, like telecom, we need to put the infrastructure out and then we'll charge a recurring fee that generates a return for us on that asset base.
Sure.
And the loan gives us a real advantage in terms of the cost of capital to build this network out.
Yeah.
And then we can pass some of that benefit on to the operators in terms of a lower cost.
So I know the picture in Colorado. I have some idea of the picture in the United States. Is this an international, do companies around the world, in some places they probably care about solving this problem, and in other places they're probably less interested in making these investments. What's your perspective?
Well, it's certainly a global issue. I mean, Greg, I don't...
Well, it's called global warming, but yeah.
Yeah.
So I think you tagged it perfectly. There are some places that care more than others. You know, we're actively... This is technology that can be exported, and we're actively working on how to build those partnerships overseas. What's interesting is that... You know, U.S. operations might look different than Saudi Arabia, where you have one operator. Here we have, 400 operators in the Permian Basin alone.
Oh, you just have to make one sale. Mm-hmm.
That's right. But it's an awfully big one. Yeah. So I think it becomes a slightly different problem to attack.
Yeah. That's interesting, though.
Yeah, certainly there's a global demand for the technology, and we're getting a lot of inbound interest internationally. Now, we haven't gone international yet, but... methane, I think, is, as a lot of people are probably aware now, is about 80 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than the exhaust from your car from CO2. And so it's the single biggest lever we have to pull. And so what you'll see from all of the oil and gas operators globally is that they understand the issue. And then just generally from a policy perspective, methane is a really important greenhouse gas to get after. And so that's going to draw demand for the ability to detect and abate these leaks.
And it seems like your technology is the better mousetrap right now, for sure.
It is.
Is it, like, can another competitor decide to use technology. What is it? Not a technology comb. What's the term?
Frequency comb.
Frequency comb. Thank you. Yeah. Can another company use frequency comb? I know you've patented for this application.
Yeah. So there's a pretty extensive. One of the nice things is that Department of Energy funding was along the way allowing us to file a lot of IP. So yeah, I can't remember how big. I think we're at 16 or 17.
17
patents around it. So yeah, wow. It's locked down pretty well.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. All right, last couple of thoughts. You know, when you think about all this, I mean, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. You told the story earlier, Greg, about, you know, that illustrated how gratifying your product is in the field. What are you thinking going forward that you like, okay, if we can achieve this, you know, it's going to be super meaningful?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as a team, you know, we set out this big, hairy, audacious goal, right, which, you know, is the big 10-year plan. And so for the company, our core purpose is to flatten the methane curve, right, is to have that level of impact. And that's going to require us to continue to grow and scale the business and find partners and go international. But that's the impact that we're after. And in doing that, I think we're going to drive a lot of value, not only for the customers, but for the company.
Yeah.
But that's kind of our North Star, I would say, is, you know, how do we have a notable impact in helping flatten that curve?
Wow.
Maybe just to put a fine point on that this is one of the unique places where we can say our company goal is to flatten the methane curve, and we can actually achieve it. And what I mean by that is methane is, again, a uniquely solvable problem in that the amount of methane that goes in the atmosphere and the amount of methane that comes out of the atmosphere, the imbalance is only 3%. Hmm. So if you reduce oil and gas emissions by 16%, the methane will stop growing. It'll flatten. And so 16% emissions reduction across the oil and gas industry, that's an achievable goal. And
wow.
it you know, might be more than one company, but in principle, it's achievable by one company. So
wow. That's pretty inspiring.
Which is to say, this climate change issue that we're all grappling with is the proximate cause is that gap between the sources of these greenhouse gases and the sinks, things that absorb. And closing that gap will flatten that curve, which will stop the process of warming. And so it's a tractable issue.
I was going to end on that, but I got to ask this. So you're saying, if I'm hearing this right, that basically stopping the leaks that happen in the field can stop the increase of global warming.
Due to methane. Yep.
Yep.
Due to methane.
Yep.
That's huge.
It's huge.
Yep. And it's not every leak. That's the other, it's, you know, 16% reduction in emissions from oil and gas.
Wow.
That's the projection. So I think it's.
Well, that must be a rush to get up every morning and think you're solving that.
Yeah. I mean, it's why we're working. Well, I'll say 80, but you're probably 90 hours a week.
Wow.
But no, it's a worthy cause.
Yes, it is. Well, let's wrap up on that note. I'm your host, Dave Tabor. Today on ProCo 360, you've been listening to my conversation with Ian Dickinson and Greg Rieker, co-founders of LongPath Technologies. Listeners, glad you're here on ProCo 360, where we say live, work, love Colorado, because you and I and my guests can be successful anywhere and choose Colorado. You make the show successful by subscribing to the ProCo 360 podcast. And if you haven't yet, it's a huge help if you submit a review in your app. Thanks again to show sponsors, Via Technologies, Kinsley Meetings, Colorado Biz Magazine, and Denver Angels. That's the show, Live, Work, Love, Colorado.